You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Kevin Alexander, an advanced heart failure trained cardiologist and assistant professor of cardiovascular medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, my name is Dr. Kevin Alexander. I'm a heart failure and transplant cardiologist at Stanford University. Welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on ATTR-CM. Today, we'll discuss heart failure ATTR-CM with our guest, Dr. Sarah Cuddy. Dr. Sarah Cuddy is a cardiologist and imager at the Brigham Women's Hospital, and she's the director of the Mass General Brigham Cardiac Amyloidosis Program. So Dr. Cuddy, if it's okay, I'll call you Sarah.
Yeah, please do.
You know, I always like to ask guests, if you weren't doing what you're doing in amyloidosis and imaging, what would you be doing in life?
Well, if I hadn't chosen medicine, and I went into medical school at 18, so I made that decision pretty early because I trained in Ireland. But while I was in medical school, I was a pretty avid rower. So I think I might have just pursued that and become a rowing coach somewhere and be out on a frozen river at the moment.
Nice. Yeah. So I'm sure you've had lots of great stories from that. I'm sure you followed competitive sports and Olympics pretty closely then. Well, great. Today we're focusing on heart failure and ATTR-CM. Could you tell us a little bit about how ATTR leads to heart failure?
In any form of amyloidosis, we think about the precursor protein. So in ATTR, it's the TTR protein that dissociates into monomers from a tetrameric form. They misfold and aggregate into amyloid fibrils, which we know can deposit in multiple tissues. But in TTR, it's really the heart that is the focus of this. So as the amyloid deposit, it deposits in the extracellular space, in the interstitium. So what we see over time is really a stiffening of the heart, a restrictive cardiomyopathy. So as the burden of amyloid grows, we just get increased wall thickness, more diastolic dysfunction, and then over time, systolic dysfunction. So just that stiffening of the heart leading to impaired relaxation and impaired contraction.
How might patients with ATTR-CM present heart failure-wise compared to other types of non-amyloid heart failure? Do you see any differences in terms of how it manifests or the progression of disease?
Yeah, well, definitely the manifestation. Often we see a lot more right-sided symptoms. So we can see a lot more lower limb edema. A lot of gut symptoms like gut edema and just abdominal distension rather than the kind of classical pulmonary edema or PND. Now, patients will experience that when they become quite overloaded. I find most of our patients manifest their fluid overload as more right heart symptoms. Often find an enlarged liver when going looking for an exam when these patients are overloaded. Then also, these patients actually become very diuretic sensitive. I think if you think of it, you know, these ventricles become smaller over time. So not only do we find that they need diuretics to kind of maintain euvolemia, but often if you overdo it on the diuretics, you can really push the patient the other way. So I find that even in itself is kind of nearly a red flag, is a very diuretic sensitive patient. I don't know if you'd agree with me on that one, Kevin.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the volume window can be more narrow than some of our heart failure patients. And totally agree that's the challenge because a little bit of volume overload can be very symptomatic and you try aggressively diurese and then run into worsening renal function and orthostasis. So really trying to capture that window, particularly in older patients, I think is one of the key challenges and differences for managing heart failure in this population compared with others. You've done a lot of work and presented at national conferences on the role of traditional heart failure therapies in ATTR-CM. On another podcast, we're discussing disease-modifying therapies and the clinical trial development in that space, and a lot's happened over the last 5 years. But I'd argue that just as important would be all the things that we do to support patients in their heart failure beyond the disease-modifying therapies. And oftentimes, those things can be the things that help patients feel better in the near term while these disease-modifying therapies, you know, take effect. Could you walk us through, say, you've newly diagnosed someone with ATTR-CM, you're starting the disease-modifying therapies, and you're reviewing their heart failure medications. How do you approach starting or adjusting heart failure medications in these patients?
One of the key things, as we mentioned, is like a really good clinical exam. And it is surprising the amount of patients who come into us with an elevated JVP, a palpable liver, and maybe not as marked lower limb edema as I would have thought, or just kind of attributed to like venous insufficiency, where we can really optimize their diuretics. Oftentimes in the sicker patients, if they're diagnosed with more advanced disease, we find we need to use torsemide or bumetanide more than furosemide for its gut bioavailability. Optimizing kind of volume, but more and more so, like, our patients are being diagnosed early. They're not coming in floridly overloaded, may even need a low dose of loop diuretic. And actually in those patients, I've really changed my management over the last 4 or 5 years. So no longer is a loop diuretic my first medication of choice for heart failure. I will start an SGLT2 inhibitor. So I'll either start empagliflozin or dapagliflozin for these patients who are exhibiting some kind of like mild volume overload, or even in the absence of kind of like overt volume overload, if I think they do have a heart failure or impaired renal function, if there's other kind of indications for starting an SGLT2 inhibitor in these patient population, I'll have a low threshold to do that. And then often actually, instead of, again, if they're developing volume overload on an SGLT2 inhibitor, instead of adding in a loop, I might think, is an MRA available for this patient? Will they tolerate it? What's their renal function like? So we'll often use spironolactone as well in these patients. And even before the advent of the SGLT2 inhibitors, we'd been using the MRAs in tandem with the loop diuretics. So that's kind of really how I think about heart failure. Adding therapies. Now, subtracting therapies, that's kind of more of a challenge. I think for a long, long time in cardiac amyloidosis, and again, talking about all forms, AL amyloidosis and ATTR amyloidosis being the commonest forms we see, the kind of headline was GDMT is poorly tolerated. And we talk about one of the red flags for disease being intolerance of antihypertensives or beta blockers. So a lot of the time in these patients, when they were coming in to see us, we will be down titrating or discontinuing these meds, usually because of orthostatic hypotension for the ACE inhibitors or ARBs. And then for rate control, if they were there for beta blockers, often these patients are very fatigued. So we down titrate or discontinue their beta blockers, often with very rewarding results. That pretty quickly the patient would say, I feel a lot better since you stopped my metoprolol 200 BID. A lot of that was really just based on expert consensus. But there's been nice data from Richard Cheng, looked at the Columbia Group's data. And then the National Amyloidosis Centre in the UK also published some very interesting retrospective data that kind of made me rethink how we do about this. Again, there was a signal, I think, to the MRAs giving some benefit. But what was interesting in the National Amyloidosis Centre subgroup analysis was in those with the reduced EF, an EF less than 40%, there may be some benefit to a beta blocker. Now, if we have time, I can get into the exact propensity score matching that they used and how that might bias that result. But in one way, it didn't make me want to start a beta blocker, but it kind of gave me confidence to say, right, if the patient is on a beta blocker and they're tolerating it, I'm going to continue it. That's kind of my general attitude to all GDMT. And I think we're just diagnosing this disease so much earlier. So a lot of these patients will tolerate GDMT and they might be on it for another reason. So if the patient is on an ACE, an ARB, a beta blocker for another reason and they're tolerating it, I won't stop it.
One of the things as a general theme in the field, and you touch on it, is that our understanding of this disease is rapidly evolving. And we, I think, historically understood and managed a subset of ATTR, usually the more advanced disease patients and restrictive cardiomyopathy. But as we diagnose people earlier, their pathophysiology and natural history are different. And also some of these earlier stage patients might have other cardiac comorbidities, you know, so it's not mutually exclusive to have ischemic heart disease and an amyloid or hypertensive disease and amyloid and so forth. And so sometimes those other things be driving the cardiomyopathy more than the amyloid if it's early stage. And so it really does take a tailored approach to managing heart failure GDMT and really trying to tease out what's leading to the pathophysiology in that individual patient. I'm very similar in that I think SGLT2 inhibitors and MRAs are terrific in the vast majority of ATTR patients. It's case by case with beta blockers and ARNIs. If they're tolerating it, continue it potentially. And if they have an intolerance, really having a low threshold to discontinue them. And so hopefully we'll continue to have more research from those groups that you mentioned, as well as our centers and others, to really understand the scenarios for when to use certain components of heart failure GDMT in our amyloid patients. I want to turn a little bit and get your take on some of the emerging device therapies that are coming out in heart failure, things like pulmonary artery monitors and CCM and other things, which are starting to be tested and used more in general heart failure. Is there any role for those therapies in your practice? Of course, there's no trial data for these things, but you know, as the data comes out in heart failure in general, have you looked into them? What are your thoughts? Do you think there's any role for them in our amyloid patients?
This is great to talk to you about this because I'm coming at this as an imager. I think, you know, you're a heart failure specialist. So sometimes I'm a little bit self-critical because I only kind of think about cardio memes after a few admissions. And then I'm like, oh man, I should really probably have thought about cardio memes earlier for this patient or like a pulmonary artery hypertension measurement device. And definitely when I've used it, it's been great. Again, it goes back to what we mentioned at the very start. These patients can have a very narrow window, and often we will give them a weight-based diuretic regimen to adjust with fluctuations in their weight. But even for some of the patients, this just doesn't work. And for those patients, the CardioMEMS device has been really great at reducing the amount of hospitalizations or urgent care ED visits.
That's kind of similar to how I think about it as well. Similar to HFpEF patients, for example, who also have narrow volume status windows. If we're really having a tough time maintaining them within a therapeutic window, then I find that CardioMEMS can be helpful in those patients for titrating diuretics. Also, too, if patients are particularly savvy and can, you know, look at data and titrate their diuretics a little bit, it's also a tool, I think, for those patients to empower them to help with volume status. I think as things like Barostim and CCM come out in heart failure, there's some promising results. And I think like a lot of things in heart failure, it'll be helpful to see in observational studies, because I doubt we'll ever get randomized studies for these devices, but how they perform in amyloid patients. You know, there's some Italian data for CCM where they've had some positive results. And so I do think that we need more data before I would use those therapies more broadly. But I think with ATTR-CM, thinking about these things as potential complements to the disease-modifying therapy is important. So I think one thing that we haven't talked a little bit about is as these disease-modifying therapies get more effective and people live longer with their cardiomyopathies, it's like the product of success like we see in, you know, say, ischemic heart disease, for example. Now you're dealing with kind of the sequelae of longer-term exposure to these diseases and probably will need some adjunctive therapies in order to keep people feeling well.
Yeah. Do you know what I kind of, not particularly related to heart failure, but related to managing the sequelae of disease. One of the things that I find a lot of the patients, when we're doing a good job with maintaining euvolemia, but they come into us saying, I'm feeling worse. Chronotropic incompetence is highly common in this cohort. A lot of the patients have been quite active earlier in their life. Most of them are now kind of older patients. And I'll say, well, your resting heart rate's 50. And they'll say, oh, it's always been in the 50s. But it kind of leads me to kind of pause for thought when someone in their 80s has a resting heart rate in their 50s, maybe dipping into the 40s. I have a low threshold for exploring chronotropic incompetence in these patients. Even sometimes just a patch monitor, and I tell them to go about their daily business. And if I don't see their heart rate going into the 80s, 90s, frequently in these patients where I suspect that their max heart rate's like high 70s, low 80s. And then obviously it's kind of a treadmill test as well. But often these patients really do benefit once we put a device in. And we always aim for physiologic pacing. So some success with his pacing, but our kind of default is for CRTP.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was going to ask you. If you're going with a pacing strategy, so you would go directly to CRTP?
That has always kind of been the way we've approached this. Often in the case, we kind of will argue that these patients pretty rapidly become pacing dependent. So we know that in the long term, they're going to be definitely more than 40% paced. So it makes sense to put in and could be justified to put in physiological pacing. And then in discussion with our EP group, sometimes they say, look, let's try and put in kind of a high RV pacer kind of HIS bundle branch, see if we can get a narrow QRS complex. And if we do, we'll leave it at that. If we don't, we'll go ahead with the LV lead.
Yeah, that's similar to our approach as well. And for a community cardiologist that's thinking about pacing for cryotropic incompetence, any advice about how you would broach that conversation with patients and counseling? Because kind of like you alluded to, it's not maybe a traditional indication, or when we think about, oh, there's complete heart block or the heart rate's 30, they need a pacemaker. They might have chronically had a heart rate in the 50s or more recently. How's your discussion with patients in terms of counseling of outlining that rationale for why a pacemaker may benefit them?
Well, discussing with the patient's probably a little bit different with discussing with maybe like a community cardiologist or their local cardiologist or EP. Often these patients have baseline very abnormal ECGs as well as the chronotropic incompetence. So you can kind of say, look, I think this is on a continuum of advancing conduction system disease. So this is probably something that I'll feel better addressing sooner rather than later. And often kind of that's how I'll end up justifying it to electrophysiologists who may not look after as much cardiac amyloidosis as the group we work with here. And kind of looking at the patch monitor, seeing this really narrow range of heart rates can kind of reinforce that. Then with the patient themselves, I kind of give my experience that this is something I see relatively commonly. And the majority of patients do come back to me and say, well, do you know what? You were right about that. I do feel better now that I have the device in. I try not to always promise patients that they'll feel better with the device in. I kind of say, like, I think this is an issue. I hope the device will make you feel better. But I also think that this is probably a sign of progressive conduction system disease, and that in the long run, you will end up needing a pacemaker. And we might as well just have a lower threshold and put this in earlier rather than waiting for an event.
Well, in the last little bit, maybe we could spend a little time talking about what happens when people have more advanced cardiomyopathy. Do you refer patients for transplant? And if so, what are the considerations and scenarios that you start to think about that?
ATTR, especially wild type ATTR, as we know, is predominantly a disease of aging. So unfortunately, most of our patients are really kind of advanced age when they develop advanced disease. Transplant really isn't a consideration. And also, there can often be a lot of comorbidities. We know from some really nice data, EGFR is a really kind of important prognostic marker, but it's also more recently been shown to also be a marker of disease progression. And worsening in EGFR predicts worsening outcomes in the long run. That can also be an issue. You know, you see a patient and not only is their cardiac function really declining, but their kidney function is also really impaired. So it's not like you're just considering a heart transplant. You can often have to consider a heart and kidney. So again, you've got a lot of complexity in someone at an advanced age. When we're thinking of transplant in this population, it's generally younger patients, and that can be wild type patients. We have sent younger patients with wild-type ATTR cardiac amyloidosis for transplant, but often it's the patients with the genetic form of ATTR cardiomyopathy that are kind of more considered for cardiac transplant. The age of disease onset is younger. And then sometimes it's just a difficult conversation when you realize you've kind of hit that end stage with the patient and involving palliative care, hospice care. It can be very challenging, and in some ways, nearly more challenging now that we do have all these disease modifying therapies, because you're talking about starting to withdraw these therapies the patients know that they've benefited from over time.
And you know, I agree the role of transplant in ATTR-CM is pretty narrow given the age of many of our patients, and tendency for this to be considered more for those V122I patients, the occasional young wild type patient. They've had a number of homozygous V122I patients in the last couple of years, and I think that they more uniformly progress to advanced cardiomyopathy, 50s, 60s, and so are kind of in that window for advanced therapies. And I think the couple of things I would elaborate on is I totally agree that watching renal function closely is important in these patients, because that can often be the thing that becomes prohibitive for considering advanced therapies. And the other thing is monitoring for pulmonary artery pressures, because of that chronic diastolic dysfunction, a lot of these patients can develop fixed pulmonary hypertension. And so that can also be where you miss the window for advanced therapy. So sometimes they may functionally be okay, but are starting to develop, you know, progressive pulmonary hypertension. And I think that that's a time to kind of step back and think about what that patient's trajectory is, because it may be by the time they have severe functional limitations, now they have prohibitive pulmonary hypertension at that age range. You know, thinking about something like a heart lung, which we do at our center, I probably wouldn't do that for an older amyloid patient. So following some of these end organ, extracranial organ things are important to make sure we don't miss that window in that, you know, small group of patients. So
yeah, going on that, actually, I had a patient recently I was looking after who I just hadn't appreciated on exam much volume overload. And he had a CT for hemoptysis and it showed a lot of changes. And the changes were thought, could these be actual amyloid in the pulmonary tissue? Or could it be kind of like, is it just chronic edematous changes, evidence of pulmonary hypertension? So in the end, we did a lot of investigations, but including in that, we did a right heart cath. He had very elevated pulmonary pressures, very elevated wedge pressure. And I was kind of shocked at myself that I kind of hadn't picked up his degree of volume overload. It kind of made me think, should I have a lower threshold for bringing patients to right heart cath if I'm suspecting possible like pulmonary hypertension and whether or not it can be adjusted by optimizing diuresis? I wonder, do you just go on clinical exam or do you have thresholds in your mind for when you bring a patient for a right heart cath?
Yeah, it's a great question. So as a heart failure cardiologist, you know, I love right heart catheterizations. And I would say for those hereditary patients, those younger wild type patients who do have a moderate disease burden, I have a low threshold to get a baseline right heart catheterization just to see where we are with things. Am I surprised that they have higher pulmonary pressures than I appreciate? Or are they normal at that time and they give me a baseline to trend, you know, if someone, you know, has progression? An 80-year-old, I probably would have higher threshold to do it unless I'm, you know, having difficulty assessing their volume exam. For those small number of patients that we still do biopsies on instead of scintigraphy because of an MGUS, I definitely ask our interventionalists to do a right heart cath at the same time. That is valuable information, so why not while they're in there? Like you, I mean, there have been patients where I've been surprised at the degree of elevated pulmonary pressures, and the only way, you know, to understand that is through right heart cath. So I do have maybe a little bit lower threshold than folks out in the community.
Yeah, I think like after managing this case and one or two others, I think that kind of thought, because I'm not a heart failure doctor, and I think I'm like, oh, I should think about right heart cath more as an option to help manage these patients. So that's kind of helpful to know your approach.
And, you know, sometimes as well, people can have exercise-induced pulmonary hypertension. And so if someone's exercise intolerance just seems out of proportion to what I'm seeing clinically, I'll have a low threshold for doing an exercise right heart cath as well. And sometimes you'll see that, you know, the pulmonary pressures rise dramatically with exertion. And so that can be helpful in that way too. We've covered a lot in a really short period of time. And, you know, some of the takeaways for me would be that heart failure in ATTR-CM patients is different in some ways pathophysiologically compared to other types of heart failure, particularly because of the diastolic dysfunction and restrictive cardiomyopathy. Volume status windows can be narrow. And so you really have to monitor diuretics closely. You taught us about some tricks about diuretic selection and considering torsemide or Bumex because of that better gut bioavailability. Totally agree that SGLT2 inhibitors and MRAs are great in amyloid and help a lot of our patients. And it's not a one size fits all when it comes to things like beta blockers and ARNIs. Certainly if the symptoms related to orthostasis would have a low threshold to stop them, but some of our earlier stage patients can tolerate them. And particularly if they have other reasons for being on them, there may be a benefit. And then finally, I think that we still need more data on the role of some of these newer devices as it relates to their benefit in ATTR-CM. I don't know if there's any final thoughts or comments that you have, Sarah, or things that I missed.
No, that's a great wrap up. I think for me, with managing these patients, even though we're diagnosing more of it, seeing more of it, it's still a pretty rare kind of disease. So always pick up the phone or text a friend when you're struggling, because it's definitely kind of talking to like my heart failure colleagues or other colleagues who look after a lot of patients with cardiac amyloidosis. I learn a lot.
Well said. So today we've talked with Dr. Cuddy about heart failure at ATTR-CM. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Kevin Alexander for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Transthyretin Amyloid Cardiomyopathy podcast series with our host, Dr. Kevin Alexander. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy.